Welcome back to the mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And this is your host, Andrew Lewis. And if you're just joining us for the first time, you'll be listening to the longest bedtime story ever to exist on the planet Earth. A special tiding goes out to all friends and family and mountain listeners in this Christmas tide. In particular, a shout out to my brother Vaughn, to my nephew George, Francesca, whose last name I don't even know, but she's a wonderful person who spent Christmas with us. My wife and dear daughter, Mary Fillmore, Emmanuel Darkor, Bill Sheffer, and the many friends who've just been of great assistance over the course of this year. And so thank you to all of you for your encouragement, and a special thank you and acknowledgement of Sue Hoppner. Although she may perhaps exist in another form now, I just would like her to know. Also, a special announcement: on Saturday, January 31st at 5 p.m., you can join the Sebastopol World Friends at the Sister City Friendship Dinner, an annual tradition where the community gathers together to celebrate Sebastopol's sister cities, their cultures, and their work for world peace. Enjoy the delightful harmony of sushi from Japan and borscht from Ukraine. Cultural entertainment will feature a Ukrainian dance ensemble and a local Japanese group, Sonoma County Taiko. Food service from 5 p.m. with a program starting at 6 p.m. featuring presentations and cultural entertainment. Pre-registration is strongly encouraged. Visit sebastopolwf.org for registration and more information. And just gotta say, if you live in Sebastopol or drive through Sebastopol, you know at least two very important things. One, Sebastopol is a nuclear-free zone. So I guarantee you 1,000% that the first nuclear strike will not, I repeat, will not be launched from Sebastopol. And secondly, that we have a sister city in Ukraine. I think its name is Chiryan. And so that deserves at least something. I strongly encourage people to go to this Sister City Friendship Dinner. A quick story. My wife, her dad was a radio man in San Diego, KFMB Radio. His name was Mac Hudson, and he was a partner on one of the biggest and longest-running drive-time radio shows in all of Southern California back in the day. And my wife would be absolutely afraid, just terrified to listen to him because she never knew what he was going to say. Anyway, for that reason, bless my family for all their goodness, and I really do hope they're not listening today. And as for today's bigger story, though it's not directly about Christianity or what some might call the coming of the Lord, well, perhaps it actually is. We'll have to maybe think about that. And I'll, in fact, do my best to keep the Christmas on this episode. Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to a really long, shaggy dog story about a walk and some statues and some paintings that were installed in a small church decades ago. I strongly recommend that new listeners get up to speed by listening to the previous episode streaming from the Mountain page on the KOWS website. But until then, know that for the last few months, we've wandered through the history of the dusty hamlet of San Diego, become acquainted with a young painter and sculptor named John Broccoli, who was commissioned long ago in the 1990s to adorn a chapel in the coastal hills north of San Diego. And we've also learned a little bit about Catholic ritual and the taking of the sacrament. So yeah, it's a lot. And I really do thank you for your patience. I especially have to ask for your patience today. And I guess that's appropriate because today we'll be talking about time. Because I'll be telling the story of James and the Monstrance. And since it's about James, I really, really need to get it right. On the downhill slope, it seems like more and more, I just end up recycling the same stories. I don't know if I'm just forgetting the ones I haven't told, or whether I hold on to some because they explain something, as if maybe they can give meaning to an entire life. And there's something else. Looking back from this late date, I sense now something truly important, and that's the fungibility of time. All change, if you think about it, is a function of time. Birth, growth, decay, physical and radioactive, happen within the domain of time. But what if time itself wasn't strictly structured, but instead malleable with a structure not of, let's say, a cage, but maybe something more like spilled syrup oozing across the surface of a table? What I'm about to tell, and my telling of it now, is somehow tied to that proposition. When the artist John Broccoli was commissioned to decorate the chapel of the Church of St. Elizabeth Seton in the town of Carlsbad, he needed the money for sure. But this effort was about much, much more than that. In his late 20s, whether he realized it or not, John had found himself in the really weird position of having to give voice to the intention of God. That's a pretty heavy proposition. You see, by most definitions, we can't see or hear or touch God. He or she or it exists beyond everything we know. So if we can't apprehend him, how can we possibly know his will on this material earth? If there is even such a thing as divine will, the only way we can know it might be perhaps through the people who choose themselves or are chosen to express that will in ways that humans can understand. These people, the ones using words and images and sound, think Christmas carols or Mariah Carey or Charles Dickens or Frosty the Snowman or midnight mass pageantry and paintings of a baby in a manger, all the people who create this stuff, they could perhaps be seen as God's agents. The ink for the Bible itself flowed from quills that were held by men. And all sacred art, all of it, every choral note, every fresco brushstroke on the Sistine Chapel was laid down by earthly beings. And yet, if God is everything, and if he is all-powerful, then all that sacred and perhaps even non-sacred art, by definition, has to be, it must be, in all of its imperfection, the physical expression of God's intent. So, if you're an agent of God, and if you're really going to do sacred art, well, you gotta be all in. If you want to understand the weight of that task, what it might entail, and the cost, it might help to know a bit about James Eckert and the monstrance for a gray horse. But here's the deal. Practically no one knows about Eckert these days. Though he worked steadily for 60 years on his craft, he wasn't the most prolific guy. You might be able to list his shows on the back of a napkin, and the number of sold pieces you might be able to count on one hand. So best not to go looking around for some catalog. That's not his measure. If you know anything at all about Eckert, it might be from the epic article in the New Yorker from 1991, back in the Tina Brown days. If it wasn't for that article, Eckert would probably have been lost to time. I certainly wouldn't be talking about him now.
Treat me like
James Eckert was born near the Puget Sound on the 19th of October, 1944. It was, I imagine, a day like any other unexceptional day in the universe. And as an infant, James wouldn't have had any knowledge, no understanding, not even an apparatus for understanding the titanic forces at work in the world. Because you see, at the time of Eckert's birth, hundreds of miles away, men had traveled by jeep to the Jornada del Muerto in the southeastern reaches of New Mexico. And there they parsed and mapped and considered the unique qualities of this place that the conquistadors had called the Path of Death. This place would have felt the footfalls of the Desert Fathers, Dominguez, and also Escalante, when they had traveled from Mexico to their commissions in Santa Fe and Zuni in the 1700s. And later, it had been crossed by Jean Baptiste and the saints of the latter days. In the summer, the heat would have been profound. There was no water. One might imagine those jeeps kicking up clouds of dust behind them. The men, they would have gotten out and surveyed that remote expanse, desert extending to the gray promontories in the distance. They would call the site Trinity. And it was here that those men and those jeeps had come to explode the first nuclear bomb. James Eckert, he grew up near the Puget Sound. Both his parents were devout Catholics. And When James grew older, he would serve as an altar boy. Sometimes he'd get up at 4 a.m. and get out of the house just so he wouldn't have to talk with his parents. And he would go to the church and he would sit in the quiet darkness surrounded by the artifacts of Catholicism that were intended to point our intention toward Christ. After Mass, he'd get back home and his parents would be gone, and so he'd skip school and just hang out all day reading and drawing. His life and his perceptions were shaped in that oblique summer light, that green summer light of the Pacific Northwest. Eckhart wasn't too good at school, maybe because he had some sort of dyslexia, or maybe because he didn't do too well with authority. But he liked to wander and look at things and draw them. As a boy, he watched the interplay of soft things, rain and rushing water, wood and leaf, and hard things like stone. He eventually ran away from home at 15, and he ended up working for a bit as a ranch hand in Nebraska before eventually coming back to the Puget Sound, where he enrolled at the Cornish School of the Arts. He didn't graduate from there either. All the same, he taught himself to be a pretty good draftsman, pretty much sketching at least an hour a day for the next 20 years. He liked to sketch dead things, and he loved roadkill. He once said that dead things didn't move, and so they gave him a chance to explore anatomy deeply. But even at this early moment in his life, Eckhart's head was filled with notions about time and longevity and life and death and physical materials and fabrication and form. At a fundamental level, even though he couldn't quite put words to it, Eckhart was interested in materials themselves and in their transformations. He was interested in alchemy and alchemical processes that could transmute one material into another. He would later say that he wanted to be able to look at anything in this world and to possess such knowledge that he could explain exactly how it had been made. Welcome back to the mountain on KOWS 92.5, All Radio, No Bowl. And I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. Oops. And if you're just popping in, we're talking about James Acord, an artist from the state of Washington. Alchemy. If you're going to understand Acord, you also have to know a bit about alchemical processes. When he was in his late 20s, Acord was really deeply into it. By his reckoning, the post-Enlightenment world might have appeared a godless place. I mean, if you think about it, when folk began to inquire into the nature of things, they basically stripped away God's mystery, revealing a mechanical and probabilistic universe that could be predicted and manipulated. In this new world, cognition and science basically assumed the power of religion. And the people trained to understand this new divinity, they became a kind of priesthood, intermediaries between the lay and those things that are holy. It's been said that when technology works, it feels no different than magic. The priesthood, this brotherhood and sisterhood of scientists and academics that exists to this day, evolved its own practices, rituals, and rites of induction. Novitiates are apprenticed, credentialed, and degreed before they're allowed to handle sacred things. And because of their power, sometimes these technological practitioners are accorded great wealth. $200 million, let's say, to the new head of Meta's AI research. Its practices are insulated from the rest of the world by an armature of institutions, tools, sacred texts, and ritualized gatherings that we call conferences. This closed world is not accessible to just anybody. If you don't believe me, try going to an academic library or checking out a book, or try to access an academic journal online. Our modern-day material scientists, the ones studying superconductivity or creating new batteries or the apparatus of quantum computing, descended from the first chemists at the dawn of the Enlightenment. Those first chemists were in fact alchemists, magicians exploring the transformation of metals. But scientific protocols hadn't yet become decoupled from religion, so in the day, alchemy was a lifelong pursuit that involved the spiritual transformation of the practitioner. It was a holy quest, because if you could understand a material, you, in fact, were understanding a parcel of God. This process of uncovering involved the transmuting of substance, of transforming the inert, the heavy, the plain, the lead, into a higher substance, a more holy substance, let's say, gold. The process called for a deep examination of the material and immaterial aspects of our universe. If you apply heat to a compound, paper let's say, you're able to render it into the constituent parts, carbon and oxygen and other trace elements. Perhaps, these early scientists wondered, it was possible to transform one element into another. If you could do this, you would be not unlike a god. It was a dangerous and powerful act. If you were going to mess with this stuff, you better take care.
Replacing a man that came before. that's just the way it's gotta be. It's always been that way. On the dark side of the moon, on the dark side.
Eckhart's short life. You know, I appreciate everyone's patience while I get to learn this board. It's all new to me. Isn't that wonderful to have new things? Anyway, in James Eckhart's life, he actually held dozens, perhaps hundreds of jobs, and he usually didn't stay for more than a few months. But along the way, he ended up picking up all sorts of new skills. He apprenticed in workshops and foundries. He learned how to weld steel and forge iron and alloy. He learned how to flame gild with mercury. And he was drawn to elemental materials, silver, salt, granite, gold, and eventually uranium. In the early days, he was fishing for something, perhaps a sculpture that could resist time itself. And he had notions of combining unlike materials to amplify their external qualities. He noticed that many art objects degraded quickly. Bronze would tarnish, cast concrete would stain and begin to crumble. He sought materials that could not easily be eroded, corroded, or destroyed. The idea emerged slowly. Eckhart wanted to create something that would honor the eternal, an object that would literally test the boundaries of time itself. Eckhart wanted to create something big, something so monumental that it would require an equally immense sculptural vocabulary. When an object degrades, it succumbs to time. So this sculpture would incorporate the right combination of materials that were complementary, that, in other words, would degrade at the same rate so that the sculpture would retain its integrity. Eckhart realized that his masterwork would have to be dense and non-porous and not be chemically reactive. His choices of material narrowed to stainless steel and granite. Granite, he learned, could last for a very, very long time. It could resist rain and abrasion. It could even withstand nuclear blasts. He wanted to create a reliquary, a container for the holy, that thing that could last forever. In 1974, in the year he turned 30, Eckhart compiled a list of all the skills he would need to make his masterwork. The skills were arcane, both ancient and modern: welding, wood carving, pattern making, casting, electroplating, acid etching, the carving of granite. In the 1970s, the last redoubt of granite carving was in Barrie, Vermont. And it turns out that Barrie granite was one of the hardest stones on Earth. Its crystals were so densely formed and hard that the rock could persist for thousands of years. And so in 1978, Eckhart loaded up his truck and moved to Barrie, Vermont. There, he would learn how they quarried granite, and he would apprentice with master stoneworkers. On his way to Vermont, as the story goes, he visited the cloisters in New York. There, the vision of what Eckhart wanted to create coalesced. It would be a sacred work, he decided. It would contain something potent, both life-giving and life-destroying, and it would somehow involve an interplay of materials. And in the understanding of the 20th century, what holy material could it contain? What thing had the power to give and destroy? In the end, it would be the thing of rain, of sky. The entity named for the first primordial being in Greek mythology to emerge from the eternal void, uranium. Eckhart would create a monstrance to hold uranium, the sacrament of the nuclear age. His sculpture would need to last at least 30,000 years. The half-life of plutonium.
Reach me.
By the sun, I'm a great time.
Hey, you're not the only boy who could ever.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, broadcast live on KOWS LP 92.5 FM from the hamlet of Occidental, California. And again, this is a Shaggy Dog story about the Monstrance and James Eckert, the artist in the 1990s and sculptor from Seattle. Next time you have a chance, go to some old cemetery nearby. Or if you live on the East Coast or in the Deep South, maybe take a close look at a Civil War monument somewhere in the center of your town. Almost guaranteed that if the details still persist on whatever rock you're looking at, it was most likely carved of buried granite. The stone faces, the hollowed cheeks or knuckled hands and weaponry retain their details. Examine, take the time to examine the delicate folds of cloth or detailed expressions on the face of an angel. Beneath the chisel of a master stone carver, buried granite can assume the fluidity of water. In the 19th and 20th century, it became the preferred material for memorials. In Barry, Eckert apprenticed with the Italian and Polish stoneworkers who had worked there for generations. It was grueling work. Blades and chisels wore out quickly against this rock, and the stoneworkers would probably never, ever have considered themselves artists. And yet some among them could elicit from the granite the tears of angels or the filigree of lace. By the 1970s, their work was a pretty rare craft. Perhaps only a handful of people in the country could actually do it. Eckert stayed in Barrie for 3 years. During that time, he lived in a freezing cottage and inhaled granite dust. He lost a finger to the diamond-edged saw blades. He spent most of his days carving tombstones. But when he was off the clock, he worked patiently on what would one day become the monstrance for a gray horse. Eckert imagined the skull of a horse, one that would be anatomically correct, and yet at the same time would remain discomfortingly abstract. It would be a sacramental vessel and carved from one of the hardest materials on earth. In its final form, it would demonstrate the entire vocabulary of stoneworking and polishing. He would essentially be painting the surface by applying chiseling and finishing techniques that resulted in a variety of colors and surface textures that would reflect different qualities depending on the angle of the light. It would mark his acceptance into a master guild of craftsmen. It would become his masterpiece. Eckert began work on the Monstrance in 1979, and the work would continue for the next 10 years. And even so, it was never completed. But this immense stone sculpture was only the first step. Eckert would have to learn electroplating to enamel the teeth with metal, and he also imagined the skull encased in polished titanium. What purpose would this object serve? A monstrance is a vessel used for the revelation of the body of Christ. But in this case, the sacramental body cannot be revealed and instead must be contained. So the monstrance skull was intended for not just revelation, but also to warn. This is you, it would suggest. Here, in this place, behold the land of death. I warn you, I am the guardian. In this winter, I am the keeper of the keys. If you proceed past this point, you shall die, and you shall enter God's kingdom. Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. Thank you so much for sticking with us today. Today's songs included Julie Paradise by The Screaming Trees, and a small footnote here, my dear wife once dated a guy who had been invited to be a member of The Screaming Trees. And in fact, if they'd stayed together, you would have had a former member of the Screaming Trees telling you this story today. We also had Oh Sister by Bob Dylan, but in this case sung by Logan Ledger and Courtney Marie Andrews. Run River by John Swift. Dark Side of the Moon by Chris Staples, and a spirited version of Son of a Preacher Man by Dusty Springfield, but in this case sung by Aretha Franklin. The Old Churchyard by Offa Rex, and we'll be closing out with Fade Into You, as sung by Mazzy Star in the 1990s. A very special thank you to the Blue Dot Session for the telling loop. For all of you, all the rest of you, or all of the ones who are currently listening in California, I hope you appreciate and receive well the moisture deluging us presently or over the last week. By all means, if you enjoyed the listen and it makes your world a little bigger, consider sharing The Mountain with your friends. I will be back in 2 weeks. If you like this effort, you can also follow us on, or follow me on, The Mountain and Adoration in a Multitude of Parts, or just Google The Mountain and Adoration and you should find my Substack page. You can subscribe, and that way I can keep you posted on various developments. Comments and feedback are welcome. You can drop me an email at anadoration@gmail.com. So with that, I will not see you or hear from you until the new year. So until then, please have a great day and treasure the good night.
I wanna take a breath out.